Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the late afternoon session here on this Friday afternoon in the Seville Room. Nothing particularly redolent. I don't smell any orange patter or anything like that. That's okay. Let them talk. I basically hate sound reinforcement, George.
But you love recording.
It is what it is. Anyway, okay.
It is easier to hear you.
Today, however, we are focused not on microphones, but on the human voice, and in particular, the singing voice. But first, before we hear the two presentations about singing voices, we're going to hear about a good friend of ours who died this year and whom we remember this afternoon. We also learned of the death of another great friend of ours, Fred Williams. So it is a sad occasion to have to make the announcement. Anyway, David Hamilton was not only a regular attendee of these conferences, but he was a lovely man, a pleasure to always be with, and he always had something interesting to say. I value the time that I was able to spend with him. He was a voice that I recognized long ago from his appearance on Opera News, the Met broadcasts, and other places, and those cultivated tones were unmistakable, as was his knowledge of the subject that he specialized in. And I want to present Seth Winner, who will offer some reminiscences about him. Seth founded Seth B. Winner Sound Studios in 1990, remastering projects for the New York Philharmonic, Minnesota Orchestra, Metropolitan Opera, Sony Music, Pavilion Records, Crystal, and Universal Records, have earned 3 Grammy nominations and 1 honorable mention from NARIS. From 1996 to 2004, he was co-chair with Gary Galo of ARSC's technical committee and a contributor to the CLIR technical report concerning analog identification, conservation, and preservation. Recent preservation and remastering projects have been undertaken for the Cy Walter Archives, the Bach Aria Group, the Princeton Symphony Orchestra with Mark Laycock, the Schnabel Family Foundation, the Benny Carter and Benny Goodman collections housed at Rutgers University's Institute of Jazz Studies, and a 4-CD package on the WHRA label, as well as a 2-CD set on the Bluebell label devoted to Jussi Björling's American and Swedish radio broadcasts, both of which were sponsored by the American JB Society. Since 1989, he has mastered the critically acclaimed Vocal Record Collectors Society annual issues. As a sound engineer at the New York Public Library for almost 25 years, he has supervised the preservation of such collections as the Voice of America, the National Orchestral Association, the Little Orchestra Society, Roberta Peters, Henry Cowell, Vincent Persichetti, Otto Luening, and U.B. Blake. He has also been the technical curator of the Toscanini collection since 1988. Please welcome Seth Winner.
Thank you, Dennis. It's so hard to start something like this. You know, back last year when David Hall passed away, I had met him a number of times. And he was like a father figure to a lot of people, but I never worked directly with him. David I had known for nearly a quarter of a century. And I had seen him when he got sick a couple of times. And it just really irked me that how Mother Nature could be so cruel to somebody who's such a brilliant man. Excuse me. I remember what Tom Owen and Adrian Cosentini both told me, who were my previous bosses at R&H, when they would work with him on the Met Opera issues and the Mapleson sets. They said they never met a man who was so prepared. He would come with the scores marked off and knew where everything was and what had to be done. Volume changes where there were clicks that had to be removed. They said they never met anybody who was so well prepared and so knowledgeable about his field that when he walked in, you felt confident. And I had that same feeling when I was working with him later on after the mantle was handed to me. Well, forgive me. This is a picture of David. I think it's in his house. The funny thing is we don't have that many photos of him, unless you go through some old magazines like High Fidelity, which he reviewed for. I remember distinctly that when the compact disc was making its debut. He was one of the panelists, along with Harris Goldsmith and a bunch of others, who were asked to listen to what a CD was sounded like versus an LP back in 1979. And he had some interesting comments in that article. I don't remember specifically, but he kind of hit the nail on the head about that he wasn't exactly overwhelmed with the sound of those of CDs versus LPs at the time. But let me continue. The Osh community was saddened to learn the death of David Hamilton, one of its longtime members and friends, on February 19, 2013. David was one of the world's most distinguished writers on music and historical recordings and an important producer of historical classical releases. What I'm reading here is the wonderful obituary that Gary Gaylor wrote that you saw posted on the website, but we're augmenting it and adding some things because he was like David Hall. You go through things and they put certain things in the, what was it, the Groves that most of this has come from?
The New Grove. Yeah.
The New Grove. But they didn't update it, and there are certain additions that we realized after we put it together we have to mention now because the man was so encompassing, just like David Hall, where he worked and what he did in the music industry. And some of this you're going to hear now are things that he relayed to me personally when we were working on things. David was born on January 18, 1935 in New York City, but was raised in Port Washington, Long Island. During a conversation about certain historic Met broadcasts up for possible issue years ago, he told me that it was shortly after his 8th birthday that he had come down with chickenpox and was listening to the January 31st, 1943 broadcast of Faust on the radio from his sickbed at home. He told me he had an epiphany during the final trio in which he decided that music, but especially opera, was going to be his calling in life. Educated at Princeton University, graduate in 1956, where his teachers included composer Milton Babbitt and musicologist Oliver Strunk, David earned a Bachelor of Arts degree in 56 and a Master's of Fine Arts in 1960. Another story relayed to me during our time working on the Met Opera historic sets was that when he had just started at Princeton in early 1953, I had mentioned that during the January 10th, 53 broadcast of Die Meistersinger, transmission was interrupted with a news flash alerting the listeners to a terrible windstorm that had closed the George Washington Bridge that day. David replied he had come up from Princeton to attend that performance and remembers having a devil of a time getting to Carnegie Hall by 6:30 p.m. after that opera to be present for the Toscanini broadcast of Tchaikovsky's Manfred Symphony that evening, which he said was quite an experience. This coming from someone who idolized Furtwängler's style of conducting. He also received a Master of Arts degree from Harvard University in 1960, where he studied with composer theorist Walter Piston and musicologist Gustav Reis. He served as music and record librarian at Princeton from 1960 to 65, and was appointed music editor at the W.W. Norton Company in 1967. Now at this point, I happened to go onto the internet and I found something. Those of you who are longtime members of Arts may remember a member by the name of John Francis who used to come to these conferences. And I found this, and it's a wonderful encapsulation of David. I met David when he was music editor at W.W. Norton and was just starting as a field rep in the college department. Then and afterwards, he was friendly and unfailingly courteous. That used to be what was called a real gentleman. He could also be quite funny. He left Norton to work on projects of his own, such as advising the Metropolitan Opera Guild in its recordings and books. He was the producer of a series of historic broadcast recordings that put together the extraordinary 10-LP historic anthology of great singers at the Met, and was editorial consultant as well as contributor to the Metropolitan Opera Guild to recorded opera, to which I made my own discographic contribution. It's neat to be mentioned in the same sentence as David in the preface. When I decided to do some recording reviews of my own in Fanfare and in the Journal of Arsk, David's pieces in High Fidelity and elsewhere were my models. I still know of no better record reviewer past or present. In less than a year, Recorded Sound had lost two of its most valuable players in the two David H's, Hall and Hamilton. The golden age of classical recordings, which they chronicled and cataloged and criticized, died before they did. And I don't suppose they will be remembered by many, even today, but they should be. John Francis. Thank you, John. I will send him an email when I get back to thank him for that. Okay. David was also musical editor of The Nation and was a contributing editor to Opus, Opera Quarterly, and High Fidelity magazines. You can find all this information at Oxford Music Press concerning all this information. He also authorized the entries in Mussorgsky's Boris Godunov, Chileo's Andrea Lukavere, and Borodin's Prince Igor for the three-volume series of opera on record published by Hutchinson and Company from 1979 through 84. He was also on the board of New World Records and on the faculty of the Juilliard School of Music for many years. Among his musical friends and acquaintances, from what he told me, and there were probably more, were Dorley and Dario Soria, Jan de Gaetani and Philip West, Garrick Olson, Michael Steinberg, the critic, Joe Maklis, and he had a written correspondence with Igor Stravinsky. In fact, David was responsible for the public memorial services accorded to Dorley, Soria, and Joseph Maklis. I can also remember David describing how he and a group of friends watched over Dorley, Soria, like a hawk, since she suffered from macular degeneration in her later years. I can also tell you a story that it'll dovetail into what Gary has to say about David and his entree into the Metropolitan Opera, which is an important part of David's life. Gary, please.
Thank you. In the early 1970s, the Metropolitan Opera started a series called the Historic Broadcast Series, in which on a more or less annual basis, they would release historic Metropolitan Opera performances, recordings of Met broadcasts. And around 1975, they issued the third installment in that series. It was a performance of Wagner's Tristan und Isolde from February of 1941 with Kirsten Flagstad and Lauritz Melchior. Now, many of us who heard that set for the first time knew that there were a couple of patches that were taken from somewhere, and the giveaway to the patches was the fact that the engineer who worked on that set didn't match the pitch of the patches to the rest of the performance. But the question was, so it wasn't hard to determine that something came from somewhere else. The question was, where did they come from? Were they alternate sources for the same performance? Were they from another performance? Where did they come from? Well, a turning point in David's career came in the late 1970s. He authored a two-part series, a two-part article called Tristan in the 1930s, and it appeared in the fall 1976 and spring 1977 issues of Musical Quarterly. In that thoroughly researched article, and the level of research in that article was so typical of David's work, he demonstrated a knowledge of historic opera broadcasts that was second to none. And he correctly identified the two patches in that Met set as being taken from a 1940 Metropolitan Opera broadcast of that opera with the same cast and conductor. This got the attention of the Metropolitan Opera Guild, and they realized the man who wrote this article knows his opera broadcasts, he knows his Wagner performances, probably second to none. Well, his observations were also published as an addendum to Conrad Osborne's review of that Met set in High Fidelity magazine. Dario Soria at the time, who was producing the Met's historic broadcast series, he was the president of the Metropolitan Opera Guild, and again, all of this caught his attention, and he knew that David was someone who really knew what he was talking about. Well, Dario Soria died very unexpectedly while he and Tom Owen were working on the final scene from a performance of Un Ballo in Mascara for release in that Met series. And so they were really caught in a bind of not only how are they going to finish the Un Ballo performance for release, but also who was going to take over the series and continue these projects. Well, because of David having written that article and the article having caught the attention of the Metropolitan Opera Guild, there was no one else to turn to. David was the obvious choice to take over the series from Dario Soria because clearly no one else knew more about Metropolitan Opera broadcasts than he did. And he took over the series and continued as its producer until the series came to the end to an end in 2008. He also produced some other things for the Metropolitan Opera. There was an eight-volume series called 100 Years of Great Artists at the Met that was released between 1985 and 1986. These were 8 2-LP sets. David chose all of the recordings for that series and served as the producer for it. So the Metropolitan Opera Historic Broadcast Series is certainly a feather in David's cap and one of his crowning achievements as a producer of historical reissues. I think probably the greatest achievement in David's career, however, at least from where I sit, was the Mapleson Cylinders, which was a 6-LP collection of the complete extant recordings made by the Metropolitan Opera's librarian, Lionel Mapleson, between 1900 and 1904. These were cylinder recordings, 2 minutes in length, that were recorded by the Met's librarian during live Met performances that took place right after the turn of the last century. All of the surviving Mapleson's were reissued, or were issued, I should say. They're not reissues. They were issued by the Rodgers and Hammerstein Archives of Recorded Sound Division of the New York Public Library in 1985. And working with executive producer David Hall, the curator of the R&H Archives, and Tom Owen, the chief engineer, David undertook the task of correctly identifying each cylinder recording. This was no mean task, because a lot of Mapleson's documentations, he had little pieces of paper that he inserted in each of the cylinder boxes that identified the cast, the date, and all of that. But the slips of paper, some of them got lost, some of them got mixed and matched and put into other cylinder boxes. So all of this had to be correctly identified. David's knowledge of the repertoire and his excellent ears made him ideal for this. He had to determine exactly what the content of each cylinder was, not only what opera was it from, and in some cases, some of the early cylinders from the first season that Mapleson was recording are barely decipherable. So even determining the repertoire was not an easy task in some cases. So we had to determine not only what works these excerpts were taken from, but the exact starting and stopping points. And he put together a meticulously prepared booklet that had texts and translations for all of the excerpts. So you knew exactly where the cylinder began, exactly where it ended, and so forth and so on. Again, a monumental task, very, very difficult. And there was certainly no one as well equipped to do this as David. I would say that booklet for the Mapleson Cylinders, if you haven't seen it, it's just a model for how historical recordings should be produced. It's an amazing feat. In 1987, the Mapleson Cylinders was nominated for a Grammy in the category of Best Historical Album. David served ARSC in a number of capacities over the many, many years that he was a member. He joined ARSC in 1987, and he served our organization as distinction, first as a member at large on the board of directors. That was from 82 to 85, and again from 1999 to 2000. He was classical music judge on the ARSC Awards Committee for many, many years, and he also served on the nominating committee. David was a presenter at several ARSC conferences and the author of a number of articles and reviews in the ARSC Journal. And in 1996, he authored an article about ARSC that appeared in Opera News magazine called Knights of the Grail. The Association for Recorded Sound Collections is devoted to safeguarding the sounds of the past. David's presence in ARSC was certainly raised the bar, I think, for what ARSC did both at its conferences and in the journal. I know from a personal standpoint, in all the years that I was reviewing for the ARSC journal, and still am, but in all the years I was reviewing during my early years in ARSC, knowing that David Hamilton was going to read my reviews, it raised the bar for what I felt I was expected to do. So his presence really helped us in many, many ways. We all knew that people like him of his caliber were rare, and the fact that he was going to read and possibly pass judgment on our work made us work all that much harder. Those of us who were privileged to know him will remember him for his brilliant mind and warm persona. David was was an individual who could always be depended upon for conversation that was both pleasant and intellectually stimulating. Although David was one of the most brilliant people I have ever met, he was also one of the least pretentious people I have known. He was a very down-to-earth, regular person who loved the company of real people and just enjoyed pleasant conversation. Peter Schambarger, our recently departed executive director, recalled that anyone who ever worked with David found him to be easygoing, knowledgeable in several areas. Peter said that he had worked with David on the board of directors between 1999 and 2001 and found David's advice on an historical perspective on ARSC to be very, very useful. He said David was also a careful listener. That's a quality that not too many people have all of the time. And David was. He would do more listening than he did talking and take it all in. He gave his time unselfishly to ARSC until he was too sick to do so, even in the last years when he stepped down from the ARSC Awards Committee due to his illness. David will certainly be missed by all of us who were privileged to know him, both personally and professionally, and through his outstanding contributions to our field. Thank you.
Thank you, Gary. You said it in a nutshell about David. When I worked with David on the Met historic issues, which started with in 1996 with the Manilow Scope broadcast from 1949, we became very good friends. And this is the kind of camaraderie I want to show you. When Tom Owen retired in 1989 as head of R&H, we had a going away party. And Tom Owen is a gentleman in the tie, and there's David right behind him. Everybody here from the staff, some of you people, veteran ARS members, may recognize this. This picture is now going back to October of 89. It's almost a quarter century ago. You know, one of our former presidents, Mark Tollison, with the mustache in the lower left-hand corner. And I'm in the back there smiling. Well, I may have had a little more hair then, but I doubt it. I do, yeah. Oh, yeah, thanks. Anyway, David had a terrific sense of humor, and just to show you, Gary, that's you. This was at a dinner in Sammy's Romanian restaurant down on the Lower East Side, and to this day, we're still trying to figure out what the two of them were laughing about. It was probably the rotten entertainment. And I think that night I went over and the guy would have a tip cup. So I put a $50 bill in and I said, don't play while we're having dinner. The moment we started dessert, he started hocking away again. So I think that was what it was about. And just to prove, Dennis, you were the witness, it was Sammy's. There's Dennis and there's the chopped liver.
This is where we used to go to get our health food.
Yes. That's some of the best chopped liver around, but do it after you see your doctor. But
Or don't bother.
Don't go to the doctor for 6 months. I just want to close with one thing about David. What a gentleman he was. I remember, you know, I had moved to Long Island, and my parents, I was taking care of my parents, and they went out to do some shopping. And David and I were working in my studio, and the entrance from the garage leads into the den area, and one door is the studio, another one is up to the stairs, up to the living quarters. And we were working on something, and my parents came back. My father opened up the door, and David just stopped. He put everything down. He didn't say a word. He went over and helped get all the bags out of the back of the car and helped my father and mother bring them up the steps. That's the kind of man he was. We would have conversations. We'd get on the phone for hours discussing what possible issues. The 1951 Rosen-Cavalier was a result of one of those discussions about what was going to come up next. He was cremated. There was no service. We're hoping, I've spoken to the two ladies that were taking care of him and watching him, that there may be some sort of public memorial in New York. I'm not sure what's happening at this stage. But it's something about what David felt, that he didn't want to inconvenience people. He didn't want a service or anything. It's like, I've been here. It was fun. I just cannot fathom, you know, when I got that notice that he had passed away, a piece of me left me. Because this was somebody that was unique. And he was so quiet, so self-effacing. But David, wherever you are, thank you. Thank you for attending.
To which I can add my own requiescat in pace.